This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In the summer of 2013, we had a great conversation here on Stateside about the Kalamazoo Gals. We met law professor and music journalist John Thomas. He wrote a book called Kalamazoo Gals, a story of extraordinary women and Gibson's banner guitars of World War II. He'd uncovered the story of women who built some 9,000 guitars at the Gibson headquarters in Kalamazoo during World War II, even though the company's official position was no instruments were built through the war. But Banner Gibsons indeed were built. And we met one of the Kalamazoo gals, Irene Stearns. Now, in the 3 years since we had that talk, there have been some very peculiar twists. So let's talk about them now as we welcome John Thomas and Irene Stearns. So good to have you both back with us.
It's wonderful to be back, and it's wonderful to be at least virtually in Irene's presence. Hello, Irene.
Hey, hi, John. Good to be here.
Great to have you with us. John, I want you to set the stage for us and remind us again about the photograph you found that set you on this voyage.
When I found a photograph that really brought together all the things in life I like, there was mystery, there was music, and a possibility of social justice. So as you pointed out in the introduction, Gibson's official position has always been, to this day actually, that it built no musical instruments, including guitars, during the war. The men who were at the factory had gone off to fight against evil incarnate, and they couldn't make musical instruments. But I found a photograph of some 75 women standing in front of the Gibson factory. It looked like 1940s to me. It turned out to be 1944. I ended up eventually finding an original print of the photograph. And I couldn't figure out why these women were there, and so I started thinking about it. I went back and looked at the company history. The person who had been the personnel director during the war, a man named Julius Bellson, later wrote a history of Gibson, published in the 70s, in which he wrote, and I confirmed this as I was doing my research, Gibson built no musical instruments during the war. And so that started me on my journey. Eventually, I did discover that Gibson built musical instruments. One of the first stops was to talk my way into Gibson corporate headquarters. A very nice mid-level executive set me up there in an office, a company guitar for the 4 days I was there, and gave me access to the World War II shipping ledgers. I photographed 4,400 pages, ended up counting those up. There were about 9,000 of these what we call banner guitars, Banner Gibsons, because of a little decal on the headstock up where the strings attach. But Gibson made a lot of other kinds of guitars and mandolins and banjos and all that sort of thing. So about 25,000 total instruments. So now I had a mystery on my hands. And it led me to write this book.
And indeed, one of the hands that helped build those instruments belonged to Irene Stearns. Irene, remind us again, what was your job? I think I remember they made very good use of your small hands.
Oh, well, I made strings most of the time, but part of the time I coiled. I liked that the best. Took the strings and wound them up, stuck them in a bag, and put them in a little box, and you had to make a set of them. That was it. So
now, about I found 12 women in this photograph, and about a third of them built strings, about a third of them did administrative kinds of work, and about a third of them built guitars. And I think that probably was a fair sample of what women did during the war. And as I've always tell Irene, without the strings, the guitars could have made no music. So that was a very important part of the process.
And these are wonderful guitars. Give us a little sample. You have a Banner Gibson with you now, John. Give us a sense of what they sound like.
I do. This is one that shipped June 23, 1943. I'll play a little snippet of an old, old song.
That is amazing to think this is, you know, we're talking about a 73-year-old guitar with this beautiful, beautiful sound. Well, when we talked 3 years ago as your book came out, you were getting the idea, were you not, John, that Gibson was getting ready to acknowledge the existence of the Kalamazoo Gals.
And that's right. Initially, of course, Gibson, I think, didn't know the story. Modern Gibson did not. And as the book was about to come out, Gibson contacted me through a dealer in the Boston area. I live out east here. And proposed a project, which was to replicate my personal guitars, to make 50 copies each of my personal guitars. They wanted four guitars. I actually borrowed guitars from friends. Two were mine, two were friends, sent them off. Everything started out happily. They were going to replicate these guitars. I had three requests. My first was not a request. I did not want any money out of this. This was just before the book had been published, but it started, and it was in process when we last spoke. I asked that the women who work at the Gibson Acoustic Division, which is in Montana, build the guitars. There were enough women to do this, that I be able to inspect the prototypes to make sure that they're up to the standards of someone like Irene Stearns, and that some portion, and I didn't specify a percentage, but some portion of the proceeds of each sale go to a Women History Project. Gibson said, great. We went off. Things looked swimming. Initially, Gibson was so thrilled. Gibson actually underwrote my book release party, which happened in Seattle. I live out east, but in Seattle is a publication for which I write often called Fretboard Journal. And in conjunction with Fretboard Journal, Gibson sponsored the book release party, flew me out there, flew guitars out, flew an executive out. We had a wonderful party, a book release. The Gibson executive spoke glowingly in front of the crowd and on camera about the project and the gals and what a unique and important part of history I'd uncovered.
So this is all sounding great.
It was great. And then it went silent. Gibson stopped returning my phone calls or emails. I wanted to know what was the status of the project, but I began to get worried about the guitars. These are, as you say, 70-plus-year-old instruments. Two were not mine. They can become very valuable over time. There weren't that many made initially, and they've suffered the ravages of time. And so at one point, someone said, I think we think the guitars are around here somewhere.
Whoa.
I finally got through. So it really scared me, again, especially from the ones that weren't mine. So it took about 10 months to get them back. I kept sending emails, which were not returned. I finally got a response to my inquiry. This is from the executive at the Acoustic Division who attended my book release party and spoke about the project. And I asked her for a status update. I've been asking her and the general manager and other people and hadn't gotten a response, but I finally got a response. In anticipation of this interview, I actually printed out that email, and here's the full response. This is the only word I ever got.
Okay.
The status of the replicas is this. We did a 1942 J45, an LG2 Mahogany, and a Southern Jumbo. All are sold out, period.
That's that.
No thank you. No thank you. No reference to the gals. Now, I can say this, that the general manager at the Acoustic Division was so excited about this project, he had scheduled me to appear with him at a giant trade show that happens every January in Los Angeles. It's called NAMM, National Association of Music Merchants. And we were going to have a press conference announcing the release of the guitars and their relationship to the Kalamazoo gals. He scheduled it for 11 o'clock on a Saturday. This is a trade show where over 100,000 people attend. He wanted to pick peak hour. And bought me tickets and a plane ticket and a ticket to attend the trade show and then went silent. That didn't happen. He didn't invite me out. He stopped returning my calls. He left the company. Everybody left the company.
Why do you think
just
this
went quiet.
Why did they ghost you like this, do you think?
I really have no idea. I mean, I have guesses.
All right. What's your guesses?
Well, I think that the company operates uniquely, to put it nicely, and that perhaps the Acoustic Division doesn't talk or hadn't gotten an okay for the project with the president who is at the headquarters in Nashville. And once they started thinking about the project, got worried. Why they'd worry, I don't know. I do know that maybe, you know, this is another case of history repeating itself, that Gibson had refused to recognize in the 1940s, but up to this day, the contributions of Irene and her female colleagues. And maybe this is another continuation. My proposition, I think I support it very well in the book, is that Gibson just didn't think the buying public would embrace female-made guitars in World War II. And it's the 40s. I could kind of understand that.
Yeah.
It looks like history repeated itself, and Gibson started thinking the same thing. I don't have a better explanation.
And I know they've actually come to the point where they say, we've never heard of John Thomas or his guitar. And then they actually were making noises about suing you.
Right. So I had two more encounters. One was a phone call. I had a chat with this woman who had hosted the book release party.
All right.
And I had tracked down the person who had been appointed to spearhead the project on the floor. This was a woman who just recently left Gibson, I think for unrelated reasons, but she was the head of the custom shop, which did all the fancy inlays. So when Johnny Depp gets a guitar with a pirate ship inlaid on it in honor of Pirates of the Caribbean, she did that work. She was appointed to head the project. She was the woman to supervise the other women. And she contacted me. I'm trying to contact her. The executives won't talk to me. I think maybe, you know, the real people will talk to me. Yeah. And she said, this executive called me in. She's my boss. She told me if I talk to you about this project, they will fire me. Kind of weird.
Wow.
So I contact the executive. I happened to be in the Northwest at the time in Montana. I said, can we meet? And she said, well, we have to meet outside the plant. We met. And I said, this person told me that you told her you would fire her if she talked to me about the project. And this executive said to me, yeah, that's right. We'll fire anybody who talks to you about the project. Like, you know, what? Why? I'm just this little guy who wrote this little book. So that was the initial inquiry and curious. The second encounter happened about a year or so later. This would be about a year and a half ago. The BBC did an hour-long radio documentary based on the book, narrated by Susie Quattro, a woman most people of my generation know as Leather Tuscadero from the Happy Days.
A Detroiter.
Program. Yes, that's right. A Michiganiter. Mm-hmm. And she narrated. She was the narrator of the program. And BBC came to Kalamazoo, and we interviewed Irene, and we did some interviews in a factory. Then the BBC had me go to London, where I got to sit with Leather Tuscadero herself in her leather pants and do an interview. And to sort of make the circle connect at the end, the BBC contacted Gibson. The head of global public relations told Gibson, we've never heard of John Thomas or his book, but he violated our copyright by accessing our shipping ledgers, to which the BBC guy said, I thought you said you never heard of him. You know, sort of a little curious. But he said, why don't you talk to her? So I spoke with her, and she told me the same things. And I said, this is kind of curious that you say you've never heard of me. You guys sponsored my book release party, paid my plane ticket, paid for the refreshments and the venue, and one of your executives came out and talked glowingly about me and the book and also the project to replicate the guitars. And she said, well, can you prove that?
Wow.
I said, well, you know, I don't have to prove it, but if you want to know, it's on YouTube. You can find it yourself, and it still is out there. So and then she threatened me with seeking remedies against him. I think that was her phrase. If I didn't reveal who let me into the building, just to access the shipping records.
I refuse to give up the name. Going down this such an odd wormhole with all of this, and I'm sure as this has all evolved, it's clear you have no clue why they're acting the way they're acting. Are you giving up, John, on Gibson, or do you still want to try to get them to acknowledge the Kalamazoo Gals?
Well, I've given up on them as far as cooperating with me. Although they don't owe me anything. But I think they owe the gals some. They're a footnote in history. I think they should do the right thing and recognize the contribution of these wonderful women who worked without complaint in the darkest hours of our country's history, built what everybody says are the best guitars in Gibson's history. And I think it would be the right thing to do in terms of social justice, in terms of humanity, in terms of recognizing the contributions of women in history, to step forward and say, hey, this is really a great story, and we would like to applaud these women who built these guitars.
And Irene Stearns, as one of the women who helped build these guitars, does it matter to you whether Gibson acknowledges you and the other Kalamazoo gals?
Well, I don't think so. I never realized all of this, you know, when I was working there. Although now I know, you know, I got fired. Now I know how that was. I didn't understand it for years, but knowing what's going on now, still going on, you know.
Irene is always so modest, but she got fired because she stood up for the rights of another female worker, a pregnant woman who was tired and needed to go home after completing her quota. And Irene organized the comrades to stand arm to arm with her, and they all got fired. So I think Irene is in her quiet and articulate way noting that Gibson has had some problems with women over the years.
Well, let me ask you this, Irene. So you've got, you know, you're thanks to John Thomas and his book, you have been in the spotlight as a Kalamazoo gal. There have been interviews, you know, documentary on the BBC, articles, a museum exhibit. What has this meant to you to know that others have certainly accepted this history and they really, really, really like it?
Well, I still can't understand it. I'm awful glad it happened, though. Because now I have John and his family and all the fun we've had, but I still can't understand how this all happened.
The book is Kalamazoo Gals, a story of extraordinary women and Gibson's banner guitars of World War II, written by my guest John Thomas. And Irene Stern's one of those very special Kalamazoo Gals. Well, it's been some weird twists and turns to the story since we last spoke, but again, it's certainly clear that based on the popularity of the book and the interest in the story, a lot of people outside of Gibson are very, very happy to applaud what you did, Irene.
Well, thank you.
John, it was always great talking with you. Keep us posted.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having us back, and especially for allowing me to chat with one of my favorite people on the planet, Irene Stearns, the Kalamazoo Gal.
Yeah.
Stateside reached out to Gibson for comment on this story, but we got no response to email and phone calls.